Hello, Hadavarnix. Shalom, Hadavarnix. Welcome to our next session in the First Regathering, Zionism and the Modern State of Israel. We're in session number 5, which is, we'll cover some background material in this session. Let's review quickly where we have been in our study of Zionism and the Modern State of Israel. We started in section 1, dealing with the spiritual war, which was our introductory material, and now we've moved to section 2. Which is some background material, the historical survey of the period from 66 AD to 1839 AD. So let's go ahead and begin the that period, 66 AD to 1839, is characterized by continuous Jewish presence in the land. Now, halfway between Safed or Svat and Naharia in northern Israel lays the little town of Pekin. Now, a synagogue can be found near the entrance to that town, and this synagogue is an ancient structure. It's claimed that the two carved stones in its walls once belonged to the Herodian temple in Jerusalem. Now, the Zainati family that worships there traces their origin back to the first century as well. The family members note with pride that they are the only Jews in Israel whose ancestors have lived uninterruptedly in Eretz Yisrael since the first century, and they are correct. They are authentic. Now, these Jews are an embodiment of a physical Jewish connection with Israel that has never been cut. And an example of this is Jews at the Western Wall in 1870. Early photo, black and white photograph here, a picture of Jews in Pekin in 1930. So the Romans may have laid the entire nation waste in AD 70 with the first Jewish revolt, and in 135 with the second Jewish revolt. They slaughtered more than 600,000, between 600,000 and 1,356,000 Jewish people. They carried off into captivity somewhere between 101,000 and 300,000 Jewish people. They carried them into captivity and slavery. However, in the aftermath of this monumental dispersion, a few thousand Jews somehow remained in the country. They were heavily taxed. They were denied the right to visit Jerusalem. But their survivors made their homes in Galilee, farming the land and working in trades. And they remained. They remained. They married. They raised families up to this very day. So the point I'm trying to make is that the modern state of Israel did not really begin in 1948. The modern state of Israel is a nation whose heritage spans the 2,000-year gap between the first century and 1948. The point I want to stress is the fact that the Jewish people may have been dispersed out of the land, and the nation ceased to be a recognized political entity. Yet Jewish people have lived in the land of Israel for the entire time of the dispersion. There's always been some Jewish people there. So we'll be looking at the rise of the modern state of Israel in this class. And as we do, we need to keep in mind that we're not studying the birth of a nation as though it was newly formed, newly created. Instead, we're studying the resurrection of a nation that's been beat up, a nation that's been dispersed, but a nation that has been in existence for some 4,000 years. Now, we'll start at a particular point in time as we look at the rise of the modern state, but that's only due to the limitations of this class. The history of the modern state does not begin with Zionism in 1839. The history of the modern state continues with Zionism. Therefore, before we get into our study of Zionism and the history of Israel, I'd like to do an extremely brief historical overview of the land of Israel from the first century until the beginning of Zionism. So we'll begin in 66 AD. The first period begins in 66 AD to 634 AD. It's the Roman period. In AD 66, the Jews in Israel rose in revolt against Rome in an effort to free their homeland from Roman rule. Now, Jerusalem fell, and the temple was destroyed in AD 70. And it took approximately 2 more years of mopping up operations to finish the job. By the way, this is a colorized version of the Arch of Titus in Rome, showing the Romans taking the menorah out of the temple. With the capture of the Dead Sea stronghold of Masada in 73 AD, the war against Rome finally came to an end. A strong Jewish presence remained in the land, though, especially north in the Galilee. Now, in AD 132, Emperor Hadrian published new restrictive laws against the Jewish religion. In addition, he decided to build a new city on the ruins of destroyed Jerusalem and erect a pagan temple on the site of the burned-out Jewish temple. The response of the Jews in Israel, we rebelled one more time under the leadership of Bar Kokhba, Simon Bar Kokhba. It took 3 years before the Romans succeeded in putting down this bloody uprising. Now, Don Cassius states that about 580,000 Jewish people fell by the sword, not counting those who perished from starvation, disease, and related causes. Many others were sold as slaves. Hadrian now carried out his plans in the belief that he could extinguish forever all Jewish hopes of the restoration of a national homeland. A new city was built on the ruins of Jerusalem and called Aelia Capitolina. Now, here's a picture of the Medeba map, and this is Jerusalem on the Medeba map. Running through the middle of Jerusalem, you see the Cardo. This is a Roman economic feature. This was the economic hub of a city, a long, long street running from one end of the city to the other, a very typical Roman feature of a Roman city. And here is a drawing that may be the way the Cardo looked. This is a possible rendition of the Cardo in Jerusalem. Here's another possible rendition of the Cardo in Jerusalem. And I like this picture. It has a cute little feature that the artist stuck in there. I don't know if you can see it or not, but there's an odd little anomaly, an odd little feature that is wrong. Something is wrong with this picture. So I'm going to let you look at it. Can you see what's wrong with the picture? I'll give you another minute. Give you another second or so. Can you see it? All right. Well, you can't see it. All right, I'll show it to you right now. Right here. See this little guy? We have a modern Jewish kid with his baseball cap and backpack getting a pomegranate from this ancient girl. You didn't notice that, did you? Yeah, it's a fun little picture that the artist drew here. But anyway, it's a rendition of the Cardo in Jerusalem. And this is the Cardo as it exists today. When you go to Israel, you can visit the Cardo and see these ruins. Now, a pagan temple was reared on the site of the old temple. An edict was issued prohibiting, on pain of death, any Jew from entering or even approaching the vicinity or the vicinity of the new city. The name of the province of Judea was changed to Syria Palestinia. The name Palestine was given to the land of Israel following the failure of the Bar Kokhba rebellion. The land was renamed the Land of the Philistines, Palestinia, Land of the Philistines. Now, in the interval between the end of the Bar Kokhba revolt and the Muslim invasion, Israel enjoyed peace from outside invasion and a measure of prosperity. But in approximately 395, the extensive territories of the Roman Empire became divided into an eastern and western part. Now, here's a map of the Roman Empire at its height, and it divided right about along that line right there. Divided into the Eastern Roman Empire with its capital at Byzantium and the Western Roman Empire with its capital at Rome. So for the next 250 years, Israel was part of the eastern half of the empire. It was this section of the Eastern Roman Empire. You'll hear this era referred to as the Byzantine era, 395 AD to 634 AD. The modern name for this period was derived from the name of the capital city of the eastern branch of the Roman Empire, which was Byzantium. The city, which gave the era its name, was rebuilt and adopted as the capital of the eastern branch of the Roman Empire by Constantine I. Now, here's a map of Byzantium. Byzantium began this as this small section at the end of the formation is called. What's it called when you have a tongue of land sticking out, surrounded by water? Anyway, here Byzantium was at the very end of this projection into the water. Then under Constantine, Byzantium expanded to this area, and finally under Theodosius, the the city expanded to its full height. Now we're going to take a look at a drawing of Byzantium, just this portion of it right here, and this is an artist's rendering of Roman Constantinople, also known as Byzantium, also modern Istanbul. This is the way the city may have looked under Rome, under Constantine. Now, Constantine officially called its capital New Rome, but it's commonly known as Constantinople. So for all of that, the time period is the Byzantine era. Now, the Jews in Palestine were concentrated during this period in Galilee, where they formed the majority of the population. The number of Jews in Palestine in the 7th century is estimated at about 200,000. Now we come to 634 through 1099 AD, which is the Arab period. Now, the long era of external peace and relative prosperity came to an end in 634 with the conquest of Palestine by the Arabs. The Muslim followers of Muhammad poured out of the deserts of the Arabian Peninsula. Here's the Arabian Peninsula to the south, and Islam's advance began in 634 AD, sweeping north, including the land of Israel. Within 100 years, they had overrun vast spaces extending from Central Asia through Northern Africa, the Spanish Peninsula, and to the very borders of Southern France. So here we have the origin of the Arab advance in the Arabian Peninsula, and pretty soon they had conquered to the north, to the east, and to the west along the top of Africa, North Africa. Finally, conquering all the way across North Africa and then turning north at Spain and conquering to the very borders of southern France. The advance of Islam. Well, there at the borders of southern France, the Arab onrush was brought to a halt by the French forces under Charles Martel. Now, during the Arab period, the Jews lived in all parts of Palestine and derived their livelihood from agriculture and handicrafts. Tiberias was a Jewish center in the 7th and 8th centuries. There were important Jewish settlements in Lydda, in Ramla, in Ashkelon, in Caesarea, in Gaza, and some Jewish people even settled in Jerusalem. There was a revival of Jewish religious life in Palestine in this era, probably under the stimulus of a vigorous intellectual activity encouraged by the Umayyad and Abbasid caliphs. Caliph means king, basically it's Muslim kings. This period saw a revival of interest in the study of the Hebrew language, a French outpouring of Hebrew poetry, and the activities of the Masoretes, which culminated in the production of the all-important Masoretic text of the Old Testament. And here's a look at the Masoretic text. Many of the synagogue songs still in use today were the works of Palestine poets during this time period. After the decline of the two great Talmudic centers in Babylonia, Palestine once again became the spiritual center of Jewry. The head of the Jerusalem yeshiva assumed the title the Gaon of Jacob. He was recognized as the religious authority for all Jews living in the territory ruled by the Fatimid dynasty. The Jewish sect of the Karaites, who rejected the Talmudic regulation of Jewish life, established in Jerusalem an ascetic brotherhood called the Mourners of Zion, and they made Jerusalem the center of their movement. And here is the entrance to the Karaite synagogue in the old city of Jerusalem today. There is a Karaite synagogue still functioning there today. However, the number of Jews in Palestine in the Arab period was not large. The political unrest and the natural catastrophes which visited Palestine in that period impoverished the economic resources of the Palestinian Jews and reduced their numbers. Now, 1099 to 1291 AD, we come to the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem. We come to the period of the Crusades. Here's a map of the area, and this is the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem, this area in the gray. Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem. The Crusades were motivated by three sets of circumstances: political, Europe's readiness for territorial expansion; economic, the desirability to establish commercial relations with the rich East; and religious, a sense of solidarity felt by Christendom in the West toward the Byzantine state representing Christendom in the East. There existed a highly emotional desire to deliver the Holy Land of Christendom from the hands of the Muslims. So there were several crusades, the first of which began in 1096. Jerusalem was captured in 1099. And the conquest of Palestine by the Crusaders was followed by massacres of the Jewish people. Now, the Crusader kingdom continued until the death of Guy de Lusignan, the last king of the Latin kingdom of Jerusalem. After his defeat by Saladin in 1187 in the Battle of the Horns of Hattin, Palestine became divided into Christian and Muslim sections. Now, Jerusalem surrendered to Saladin in October 1187, and the period finally closed in 1291. The next major period we come to is the period of the Mamluks, 1291 to 1516. The word Mamluk means slave. The reason for this name lay in the fact that they were foreign slaves. Some of them were Turkish, others were Circassian descent. 47 of the Mamluk sultans reigned in the space of 276 years, and only one family retained power for four successive generations. Most of the others lasted only a period of a few years. Some of them were insane, others were illiterate. Many came to the throne by assassinating their predecessors and were in turn murdered themselves. And yet the Mamluks repelled successive invasions of the Mongols and completed the liquidation of the Latin colonies in the Near East. There was a constant trickle of Jewish immigrants to Palestine during the Mamluk period. Starting in 1517 to 1917, we have the period of the Ottoman Empire. So while the Mamluk Empire was decaying from within, the Osmanli Turks, better known as the Ottoman Turks, were moving up into the forefront of events in Asia. And here is a map of the Ottoman Empire. And of course, Israel is one small section of the Ottoman Empire. In 1453, Constantinople fell to their arms, and thus came to an end the eastern division of the Roman Empire. In 1517, under the leadership of Selim I, Syria, Palestine, and Egypt were overrun. In the beginning of the Ottoman rule, Syria and Palestine were rearranged for administrative purposes. Palestine, as under previous regimes, did not form a single administrative unit. Jerusalem, Nablus, Gaza, Sidon, and Beirut constituted one unit, while Galilee became part of the Pashalik of Sidon. These administrative districts constantly shifted, but Israel was never an independent unit. Now here's a picture of independent Sanjak of Jerusalem, shown within the Ottoman administrative divisions in the eastern Mediterranean coast after the reorganization of 1887 and 1888. This is the independent Sanjak of Jerusalem. It's basically Judea. And then to the north, Galilee was made up of the Sanjak of Beirut, Sanjak of Acre, and the Sanjak of Balka. And again, these divisions constantly shifted. And for defensive reasons, Suleiman the Magnificent rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem, which are said to be the same walls surrounding the old city to this day. So here is you can see the walls and from the Mount of Olives. Here's a little close-up of the southern wall and the eastern wall. And here I focused in more on the southern wall built by Suleiman the Magnificent. And, of course, along the eastern wall is the very famous Golden Gate. But this is an Arab gate that sits above the original Herodian Gate. The original Herodian Gate is below that structure. For the first 200 years of Turkish occupation, Palestine, while ravaged by incessant internal wars, experienced no invasion from outside. The first such invasion came at the very end of the 18th century during the Napoleonic Wars. And of course, the Napoleonic Wars were headed up by Napoleon Bonaparte. After occupying Egypt in July of 1798, Napoleon crossed into Palestine in the beginning of 1799. He moved into Palestine, he moved north up the coast, he He took Jaffa. Continuing north, he laid siege to Akko. He never did capture Akko. Jerusalem was never attacked. Now, in June, Napoleon recrossed into Egypt, and in August 1799, he left for Europe. Now, Turkish policy was favorable to the Jews in general. The Turks probably aimed to attract the Jewish people away from the oppression of the European countries in order that the Turkish Empire might benefit from Jewish economic activities. Accordingly, Palestine received a sizable influx of Spanish Jews when the Jews were driven out of Spain in 1492. Now, Galilee was still the center of Jewish population in Palestine, and Sfat, or Safed, located in the Galilee, was the most important city where Jews developed a thriving wool weaving industry. Now, Sfat, or Safed, was also known as a center of Jewish mysticism. Now, in Safed lived Joseph Caro, a Spanish-born Jew who was raised in Turkey. Caro combined with his Jewish mysticism a profound knowledge of the Talmud. It was he who composed the Shulchan Aruch, designed to regulate the daily life of the Jew in accordance with rabbinic teachings. Now, another Jerusalem Jew, Isaac Luria, was active in Sfat, or Safed, as well. Under his leadership, the Zohar became the absorbing study of Jewish mystics. Now, Safed had a Jewish population of 15,000 by the middle of the 16th century. In addition, the city of Tiberias was built along the Sea of Galilee. Now, Jerusalem occupied third place as the center of Jewish residence and intellectual activity. So it was Safed, Sfat, Tiberias, and then Jerusalem. Hebron. Hebron had a small Jewish community which was struggling for survival amidst a powerful and hostile Muslim populace, and that is still true even today. So the Ottoman Empire grew. This is the extent of the Ottoman Empire in 1566 upon the death of Suleiman the Magnificent. It expanded a little bit further, and this is the greatest extent of the Ottoman Empire by 1683, and then it went into decline. By 1914, it was limited to the Arabian Peninsula and the area of Turkey, the Middle East there. And by 1923, it was limited strictly to the area of Turkey. So the Ottoman Empire then came to a close. And we now I'd like to summarize this period of history from 66 to 1839. During all this period of nearly 2,000 years, Palestine was not even a name on the political map of the world. It was always a portion of a larger province, Roman, Byzantine, Arab, or Turkish. Its people were never conscious of themselves as a national unit, nor did they ever attempt, as had been done earlier during Israelite days, to form an independent kingdom. At no time in the recorded history of Palestine was the country one independent political state except under the Jews. There has never been a Palestinian state that has been there from time immemorial. Never. Palestine was only an independent political state under the Jews. And it was known as Israel, and then the name changed by the Romans to Palestine, and of course the name changed back when the modern state came into being. Name changed back to Israel. You see, Palestine's political identity was destroyed when the Jewish national homeland was destroyed by the Romans. By the end of the 19th century, the Jews began to return to the country with a renewed determination to rebuild, that's the key word, rebuild their national homeland. And so Palestine, once more, reemerged from obscurity. And when in 1948 the State of Israel was reestablished, Palestine became again, after the lapse of more than 2,000 years, an independent state. And of course, it was the name of that state was changed to Israel. So with this background in mind, let's pick up our study of Zionism proper. We're now at Roman number three in your outline. We began with the spiritual war, major section number one, then Roman number two, the background, We've just looked at the historical survey of the period. And now we move into section 3, 1839 to 1947, the modern Zionist movement. Now, you'll notice that I haven't supplied you with a traditional outline for this class. I've supplied you with a timeline. We're going to work down that timeline year by year, covering the important people and events in chronological order. I'm doing this because previous courses of this nature that I've listened to usually tackle the material topically rather than chronologically. And when that happens, I get really lost. I lose my reference point regarding when an event or movement got started and how it expanded and developed. So for me, I need a starting point to orient myself. I do better when I see the events unfold step by step, one after the other. So because I wish that others had taught this material chronologically, I thought I would give it a try myself. So that's the reason I do it. So we've studied the situation in the land of Israel from the first century until 1839. In 1839, the beginnings of the modern Zionist movement begin to appear. Now, at this point in the class, you need to be familiar with a number of political and economic terms that will be showing up on a regular basis. Now, on pages 50 and 51 of your outline, you will have a page of definitions, the definition of democracy, socialism, communism, and capitalism. So read over that page so you understand more clearly what these terms refer to. Now, if you haven't downloaded the outline or don't have this material, you can go to an online resource like dictionary.com or Wikipedia, but look up the definitions of democracy, socialism, communism, and capitalism. Those factors will show up quite regularly in the continuing parts of our study. All right, we're at the table of contents, Roman numeral number three, the end of exile. Now, at this point in time, two brands of Zionism will emerge: religious Zionism and secular Zionism. Religious Zionism operates under the philosophy of redemption. The proponents of religious Zionism were Judah Alkali. He stated that tradition allows us to return to the land of Israel, and then Zvi Hirsch Kalischer. And his point was, pay no attention to the tradition of waiting for the Messiah. We can move ahead with the redemption. We don't have to wait for the Messiah. Now, secular Zionism's motivating factor was anti-Semitism. This was promoted by Moses Hess. He stated our physical existence is at stake. And then Leo Pinsker stated what people fear they hate. So this is the two strains of Zionism that is going to appear. So we'll talk about them. We'll talk about the people God used as they began the Zionist movement: Alkali, Kalischer, Hess, and Pinsker. We'll also look at the circumstances that God orchestrated to create the modern state of Israel. So let's begin in 1839 with Judah Alkali, Rabbi Judah Alkali. We begin in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, with this Orthodox rabbi. Now, Judah Alkali was born at the end of the 18th century. Alkali was an obscure preacher in the little Sephardic community of Semlin near Belgrade in modern Serbia. So here is Serbia. You can see on the left of the map, Serbia in Europe. On the right, you can see Belgrade, the city of Belgrade within Serbia. And now within Belgrade is the area of Semlin. Within Belgrade, this is where Judah Alkali was a preacher. In 1839, he astounded his congregants by publishing a Ladino Hebrew handbook. The Ladino was the language of Spanish-speaking Jewry. It was a textbook called Darche Noam, Pleasant Paths. In the introduction, he alluded to the need for establishing Jewish colonies in the Holy Land as a necessary prelude, to the redemption. In his later writings, the best one known is Shema Yisrael, Hear, O Israel, Alkali noted that self-effort taken by Jews toward establishing the redemption was justified by the very proof texts of tradition. In other words, Jews could work for establishing the redemption. They didn't have to wait for the coming of the Messiah. Tradition allows us to return. We can go ahead and do this. The dominant view in Jewish life at that time was the view that the Messiah had to come before Israel could return to the land. But he said, no, we can return to the land before the Messiah. Now, in 1840, a significant event occurred in Damascus that influenced his thinking very deeply. So we come now to 1840 and the Damascus blood libel. Here's an article about the blood libel event. You can read it on Wikipedia. The Damascus affair was an 1840 incident in which the accusation of ritual murder was brought against members of the Jewish community in Damascus. Eight notable Jews of Damascus were falsely accused of murdering a Christian monk. They were imprisoned and tortured. Several of the imprisoned died of torture, and another was forced to convert to Islam. In addition, the Muslim populace of Damascus fell upon the Jewish synagogue in the suburb of Yobar, pillaged it, and destroyed the scrolls of the law. Negotiations in Alexandria, Egypt, secured the unconditional release and recognition of innocence of the nine prisoners still remaining alive. That was out of the 13 that were imprisoned. In a new and groundbreaking effort, the American Jewish community of 15,000 protested in six American cities on behalf of their Syrian brethren. For the first time in American Jewish life, Jews organized themselves politically to help diaspora Jewry in distress. So in 1840, the efforts of influential Western Jewish leaders achieved the release of these unfortunate Jews imprisoned in Damascus on blood libel charges. Now, what is the blood libel? I need to make sure you know exactly what that is. The blood libel, also called the blood accusation, is a false accusation or claim that Jews kidnapped and murdered the children of Christians to use their blood as part of their religious rituals during Jewish holidays. This is the most idiotic and ridiculous accusation ever to come to light, but it's still alive even today, even in modern times. The blood libel. A bunch of anti-Semitic garbage. Now, Alkali detected in this miracle of vigorous secular action a precedent for the future stages of redemption in Palestine. In 1843, he wrote a book entitled Minchat Yehuda, The Offering of Judah. And in this booklet, he declared, "It is written in the Bible, Return, O Lord, unto the tens of thousands of the families of Israel. But upon what should the divine presence rest? On sticks and stones? Therefore, as the initial stage of the redemption of our souls, we must cause at least 22,000 to return to the Holy Land. This is a necessary precondition for a descent of the divine presence among us. Afterward, he will grant us and all Israel additional signs of his favor." So is his point, is the divine presence going to rest on sticks and stones? No. It's going to rest on people. There has to be Jewish people in the land before the divine presence will come down. And he calculated somehow that we need at least 22,000 Jewish people, and then the divine presence would bless us. How he calculated the 22,000, I have no idea. But this was his position. We need to get back to the Holy Land so that the divine presence can descend upon us. Now, during his remaining 35 years, Alkali continued to publish his ideas extensively. In the end, he himself settled in Palestine as an example to others. And here's a portrait of Rabbi Yehuda Alkali and his spouse Esther in 1874 before their immigration to Palestine. So he put his money where his mouth is. He preached, we need to go back to Palestine. And as an example, he went ahead and did it himself. Now, before his death in 1878, the energetic rabbi managed to organize a small group of followers. One of his disciples was Simon Loeb Herzl, the grandfather of Theodore Herzl. All right, now we come to 1843 and Zvi Hirsch Kalischer. Now, Alkali's views were paralleled to a remarkable degree by a contemporary and a colleague, the Orthodox rabbi Zvi Hirsch Kalischer. Kalischer served a large congregation in the Polish-speaking city of Thorn, East Prussia. Now here's a map of Prussia. This is Prussia. And of course this is East Prussia. And this is the region of the city of Thorn. Now, Kalischer enjoyed a rather substantial following. As a result, he was given an immediate and respectful hearing. In 1843, he published his views in a two-volume work entitled Emunah Yesharah, An Honest Faith. Here it is, Emunah Yesharah, An Honest Faith. In 1862, he completed his presentation with a final volume, Drishat Zion, In Search of Zion, Drishat Zion. Now, three principles were developed from these volumes. Number one, the salvation of the Jews, as foretold by the prophets, could take place through natural means, that is, by self-help, and did not require the advent of the Messiah. So that's very similar to Rabbi Alkali. Number two, colonization of Palestine should be launched without delay. That's exactly what Rabbi Alkali did. He himself went to the Holy Land. And thirdly, the revival of sacrifices in the Holy Land was permissible. So Kalischer wrote, "Pay no heed to the traditional view that the Messiah will suddenly loose a blast on the great shofar and cause all the inhabitants of the earth to tremble. On the contrary, the redemption will begin with the generation of support among philanthropists and with the gaining of the consent of the nations to the gathering of the scattered of Israel to the Holy Land, into the Holy Land." So it'll be happen by natural means. People will give money, the nations will give permission, and we'll be able to return to our land. Now, only when many pious and learned Jews volunteered to live in Jerusalem would the Creator hearken to their prayers and speed the day of redemption. So again, very similar to Judah Alkali. So this is a paradigm shift in Jewish thinking at this time. We can go back to the land and begin as a prelude to the redemption. Now, in addition, Kalischer urged four more steps be taken. He said, we need to form a society of rich Jews to undertake the colonization of Zion. Secondly, settlement by Jews of all backgrounds on the soil of the Holy Land was necessary. Thirdly, we need to train young Jews in self-defense. That was a very wise principle and a necessary principle. And fourthly, the establishment of an agricultural school in the land of Israel where Jews might learn farming and other practical subjects. Again, a very practical principle to bring forth. So Kalischer's notion of practical messianism was appealing enough to win over a small but influential group of contemporaries who joined him in founding a society for the colonization of the land of Israel. Now we move to 1856 and the Hayishuv Hayashan. Now during this time, Jews were filtering back into the Holy Land. In 1856, the Jewish population exceeded 17,000. Most of these newcomers were devoutly religious, and as a result, about a third of them chose to live in Jerusalem. The name attached to them was Hayishuv Hayashan, the old settlement. Their motivation was the sacred mission of living, worshiping, and dying on holy soil. And here is a picture of Jews in Jerusalem during the old Yishuv. Now, few of the Jews in Jerusalem or elsewhere in Israel were self-supporting. They depended heavily upon the charitable generosity of Jews abroad. By the 1860s, the systematic collection and distribution of these gifts amounted to half the income of the Jerusalem Jews and one-third the income of the rest of the Palestine Jewry. And this system of charity became known as Halukah. Now, during this time, a tremendous national awakening was sweeping Europe. And Rabbi Kalischer wrote in one of his articles, "All the other peoples have striven only for the sake of their own national honor. But how much more should we exert ourselves? For our duty is to labor for the glory of God who chose Zion." So he had a very religious, spiritual motivation behind his thoughts that we needed to reestablish the Jewish national home. Now, one of the most original responses to this nationalist awakening in the 19th century was the response of Moses Hess. All right, remember now there's two strains of Zionism growing, religious Zionism under J- Judah Alkali and Zvi Hirsch Kalischer. And now we come to secular Zionism, whose motivation is anti-Semitism. Moses Hess will state, our physical existence is at stake. And Leo Pinsker will state, what people fear, they hate. All right, so let's begin with 1862 and Moses Hess. Moses Hess publishes Rome and Jerusalem in 1862. Now, just to get a fix on this for those of us who are in America the Civil War had begun. Abraham Lincoln was our president at this time. Now, Moses Hess was the son of an Orthodox Jewish family in Bonn, Germany. Now, here's Germany, and you can see the town of Bonn located in western Germany. This is where Moses Hess hailed from. In 1857, the writing of Rabbi Kalischer was drawn to his notice. So here's the connection. He started to read Rabbi Kalischer's stuff. These writings impelled Hess to begin a systematic study of Jewish history. The result was Hess's second book, Rome and Jerusalem, published in 1862. And I think it's still it appears to be still available on Amazon.com. Now, this book asserted that return to the land of Israel was indispensable if the Jews were to shed their function as an historical anomaly, an historical abnormality, a social parasite in the lands of other peoples. Only in ancestral soil could Jewish labor find it possible to organize under correct socialist principles. He was a socialist. Hess issued the warning that a national homeland offered the Jews their last and best chance of self-transformation into a normal people. We would be freed from the vulnerable phantom status that historically provoked anti-Semitism. This was his understanding of why anti-Semitism existed, because we were a people without a country, floating around in a country that was not our own. Now, Rome and Jerusalem ignited no fires in the Jewish world, not in 1862. Only 200 copies of the work were sold in the 5 years after its appearance. Now, Hess's writings carried a warning that more than Jewish religious or national ideals awaited fulfillment in Palestine. Sheer physical existence was also at stake. He was anticipating Kristallnacht in 1938. Kristallnacht, the night of the broken glass, the beginning, really this is the beginning of the Holocaust. He understood what was coming down the pipe. All right. He insisted we shall always remain strangers among the nations unless we get our own nation. All right, 1869, Nachlat Shiva, the plot of the seven, is purchased. During this period of time, doubts were accumulating in the Orthodox settlers regarding the viability of the Chalukah system. Men of unquestioned Orthodox persuasion began to see the Chalukah charity system as detrimental to both reverence and to survival. In 1869, the leader of this group, Joel Moshe Solomon, and six of his friends, bought a tract of land outside the city wall of Jerusalem. Here's the old city. And outside the city walls, they built this little tract of land they entitled Nachlat Shiva, the plot of the seven. The purchase represented Jerusalem Jewry's first voluntary, self-financed undertaking beyond the ancient Jewish quarter. And here is Rivlin Street in Nachlat Shiva today. This is the way it looks today. All right, 1870, Mikvah Yisrael. You'll remember back to my remarks about Rabbi Kalischer, and you'll recall that he advocated the establishment of an agricultural school in the land of Israel where Jews might learn farming and other practical subjects. At Kalischer's initiative, the Alliance Israelite Universelle, this is a renowned French Jewish philanthropy, provided the initial subsidy for a Jewish agricultural school in the Holy Land. It was established near Jaffa in 1817 and was called Mikveh Yisrael, the Hope of Israel. You can see on the left, the modern map of the modern state, and then on the right, that rectangle is highlighted, and I've placed Mikveh Yisrael approximately where it exists today. This school would eventually have a lasting positive impact on the resettlement of the land. Here is the synagogue in Mikveh Yisrael today. It's a thriving little community in Israel. Now notice that name, Mikveh Yisrael. It will crop up time and time again during our study. 1874, experienced the death of Zvi Hirsch Kalischer. He died in Thorn, West Prussia, Kingdom of Prussia, and the German Empire. Death of Zvi Hirsch Kalischer. All right. Late 1870s, Chovevi Zion. In the late 1870s, Zionist study circles and clubs had begun to function in the hundreds in Russia. Some called themselves parties or assemblies. A number adopted such titles as Ezra or Maccabi. They were generally known as the Chovevi Zion, the Lovers of Zion. You'll also hear them referred to as the Chibat Zion, the Love of Zion. Now, these are essentially synonymous terms, but there's a distinction between them. Chibat Zion is a term that primarily identifies the ideology, the love of Zion, the philosophy. Chovevi Zion identifies the people who held to this philosophy, the lovers of Zion. So Chibat Zion, the philosophy that of love of Zion, and the Chovevi Zion, those who adopt this philosophy, the lovers of Zion, the people. A philosophy and a people. Now, the common ingredient was the acceptance of their credo, there is no salvation for the people of Israel unless they establish a government of their own in the land of Israel. Now, a few of these early groups simply offered courses in Hebrew language and history. Others established choirs or gymnastic and self-defense organizations. The meetings were conducted secretly for Zionism. Like other varieties of minority nationalism, were quite illegal in Tsarist Russia, the Tsarist Empire. So at this time, there was no central direction to the Chovevi Zion cause. It was very informal, wasn't formally organized and have a road to go down. All right, 1874, Mea Shearim, 100 gates is purchased. This is the second Jewish quarter built outside the old city walls. Okay, and here's Nachalat Shiva, the old city. And again, just close by to Nachalat Shiva is Mea Shearim. And it is now inhabited by the ultra-Orthodox. It's well known because they have placed signs requesting that ladies especially wear modest clothes when they're going through their neighborhood. They try to protect the sanctity of their neighborhood very, very strongly. And here's a picture of Mea Shearim today, just a picture of the area. And here's another picture of Mea Shearim as it exists today. All right, 1878, Petach Tikva founded. In 1875, Joel Moish Solomon, the man who spearheaded the purchase of Nachalat Shiva, embarked on a quest for farmland. The search took 3 years. In 1878, an available tract of land was located and purchased in the Sharon Valley, 6 miles from Jaffa. It was a wild and desolate stretch, lacking roads or assurance of Ottoman police protection. Remember, Israel was under the Ottoman Empire at this time. Even so, the soil appeared fertile. Water was available from the nearby Yarkon River. Mud huts were erected for 26 initial families. Solomon and his contemporaries dubbed the settlement Petach Tikva, Portal of Hope, Petach Tikva. Unfortunately, the river was not only a source of water, but also of mosquitoes. During the project's first year, many of the farmers were struck down by malaria. Some died. Others were deserted by their families. Until the first grain harvest, the survivors were continually racked by hunger and disease. And when the crops were reaped in, they found no market among the Jews of Jerusalem, whose religious leaders were unforgiving of Solomon's heresy. They thought he was really, out in left field with what he was doing. In the second year, the Archon flooded the settlement, and broken now in body and spirit, the Jewish farmers abandoned their effort and returned to Jerusalem, and Petach Tikva lapsed into a wilderness. It would spring to life again in 1882, and it is alive today. Here's Petach Tikva in 1912, and this is the great synagogue at Petach Tikva today. So it is very much alive today. 1878, we come to the death of Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai. This is his and his wife's grave on the Mount of Olives. Death of Yehuda Alkalai. 1881, Eliezer ben Yehuda arrives in Israel. During the years prior to World War I, a crucial linguistic framework was being established for the Zionist redemptive effort. While Hebrew studies did exist in outside the land of Israel under the Chovevei Tzion groups, they were virtually non-existent in the Holy Land itself. Until the late 1870s, the handful of Jewish schools operating in Israel were almost entirely religious and conducted in the Yiddish language on antiquated Orthodox lines. The emergence of modern Hebrew, a language capable of secular vernacular use, awaited the heroic achievements of a sparrow-chested little Russian Jewish philologist, Eliezer Perlman. He was a philologist. Philology is the study of linguistics, the study of a language. So he was a philologist, Eliezer Perlman. He's better known by his adopted surname, Eliezer ben Yehuda. Eliezer ben Yehuda. He was born of Orthodox parents and received a religious education. Eliezer, however, joined thousands of his generation in turning from Orthodoxy to Haskalah secularism. The Haskalah movement was a Jewish philosophical movement in Europe that stressed secularism and assimilation. From Haskalah, Eliezer turned to Zionism. His vision of language as the decisive component of modern nationhood awaited his years as a student at the Sorbonne. There he became acutely conscious of the role of literature in the growth of French nationalism. So he wrote his fiancée in 1880. He said, "I have decided that in order to have our own land and political life, it is also necessary that we have a language to hold us together. That language is Hebrew, but not the Hebrew of the rabbis and scholars. We must have a Hebrew language in which we can conduct the business of life." So in the following year, 1881, Ben Yehuda, 23 years old, married his fiancée, Devorah, and she was age 27, and they departed for Israel. From the moment they boarded the ship, they vowed to speak no other language than Hebrew, and that pledge was never broken. Here is their son, Ben Zion Ben Yehuda, first modern Hebrew-speaking child. He was raised on modern Israeli Hebrew. Now, the couple's next years in Israel were poverty-stricken. Here is Ben Yehuda and his wife Devorah in 1882. Soon after their arrival in Jerusalem. Now, in Jerusalem, Ben Yehuda earned a pittance teaching Hebrew for an alliance school. His every free moment was devoted to editing a succession of Hebrew language newspapers. So here's a picture of Ben Yehuda at work. I don't know if he's working on his dictionary or the newspaper at that point, but just a picture of him busy at work. Now, in the 1880s, the circulation of these newspapers barely exceeded 200. There were occasions when he and his family were evicted from their home for lack of rent money. At times, they nearly starved. Ben Yehuda did not make his situation easier because he incessantly attacked the Orthodox. He constantly upbraided them for their opposition to secular Hebrew, their opposition to secular labor, and for fostering the chalukah, the charity community. He called chalukah a social crime. The Orthodox retaliated by stoning his office and by denouncing him to Ottoman authorities for treason. He was once briefly jailed. They also placed him under the rabbinical ban of excommunication. When his wife, Devorah, died in 1891, the Orthodox refused her burial in the Ashkenazic cemetery. After Devorah's death, Eliezer married Devorah's sister, Hemda, This is Eliezer and Hemda ben Yehuda. And here is a portrait of Hemda herself. So he married Deborah's sister, Hemda. Now, the retaliation that I've just told you about still goes on today, long after Ben Yehuda's death. The Israeli government considers Ben Yehuda's home an historic spot, an historic building, and so they've marked the house with a plaque. However, whenever the government puts the plaque up, the Orthodox tear it down. This putting up and tearing down still goes on even today. When I visited Israel in 1994, we walked by Ben Yehuda's house. Here's Eliezer Ben Yehuda's house. And there on the wall, by the door, was the obvious place where the memorial sign had once been affixed. So I didn't get to see it. But if you're lucky, you'll get there when the memorial plaque is in place. And there's the way it would look with the plaque in place. Well, Ben Yehuda's work began to have an impact. Soon all the agricultural colonies subscribed to his newspapers and purchased his textbooks. He became a power in the Yishuv and eventually in the Zionist world at large. By the turn of the century, he was well launched on the project that would absorb the remainder of his life, the creation of a Hebrew dictionary. Here he is at work on his dictionary. Pursuing his research with books and other materials sent him by disciples in Europe, he relentlessly tracked down the Semitic roots of words that ultimately were incorporated into the contemporary vernacular. By 1904, modestly endowed at last by grants from Jewish sources, Ben Yehuda published the first volume of his dictionary. It was virtually an encyclopedia of the Hebrew language. It was a monumental work of scholarship. He would complete three more volumes before his death. Afterward, the undertaking would be expanded by his successors into a 17-volume series, and apparently you can get the 17-volume series, the Complete Dictionary of Ancient and Modern Hebrew by Eliezer Ben Yehuda, apparently available on Amazon for the paltry price of $850. If you've got $850 flowing around, you can probably pick this up. So this dictionary became the definitive basis for a revived spoken and written language, Hebrew language. In putting Hebrew into vernacular use, Ben Yehuda counted heavily on the Yeshuv's teachers. At the turn of the century, the largest number of these were employed by the Hilfsverein der Deutschen Juden. Hilfsverein der Deutschen Juden. I think I'm pronouncing it fairly decently. I don't know German, so if you speak German, please be patient with me. I'm trying to pronounce it correctly. This is a German financial aid society. In 1914, Hilfsverein operated a network of 50 schools throughout the Yeshuv, from kindergarten through secondary institutions. They provided instruction for 7,000 children. It was due mainly to Ben Yehuda's efforts that the Hilfsverein laid a renewed emphasis on Hebrew studies. The Alliance schools were conducting the major portion of their instruction in Hebrew, as were the schools in the Zionist agricultural colonies. Additionally, 60 Zionist schools in the towns and outlying farm colonies, some 2,600 students, were using Hebrew as their sole medium of instruction. Most of the Zionist farmers and workers fully accepted Ben Yehuda's contention that a nation was its language, no less than its sweat and blood. Now, just before World War I, the directors of the Hilfsverein schools began offering a number of courses taught exclusively in German. The issue of German versus Hebrew did not become an urgent issue until plans were laid to establish in Haifa a Haifa Technical Institute. Funds for such a technion had been available from the estate of Wolf Vysotsky, a Russian-Jewish tea merchant, and you can even get Vysotsky tea still today. Here's Vysotsky tea, still available today. Anyway, he donated money for the technion. The Jewish National Fund supplied the land in Haifa with the Hilfsverein in the administrative agency, as the administrating agency. The Hilfsverein was determined that the technion would be the very capstone of the Yeshuv's educational structure. The German Jewish members of the Technion's Board of Governors proposed that all technical subjects be taught exclusively in German. German was recognized as the language of science and Hebrew. In contrast, Hebrew was deficient. Excuse me. German was recognized as the language of science. Got it. And Hebrew, in contrast, was deficient in technical vocabulary. The decision produced a wave of indignation for the Zionist settlers. Ben Yehuda was infuriated. He warned the Hilsvarian's directors that blood would flow in the streets. At Ben Yehuda's instigation, protest meetings were organized by Jewish students and by Jewish teachers throughout the Yeshuv. In October of 1913, the Hebrew Teachers Association proclaimed a strike in all Hilsvarian schools, and the students demonstrated outside the German consulate in Jerusalem. The Technion crisis seemingly threatened the entire Hebraic nature of the Zionist Renaissance. Aware of what was at stake, the Zionist organization immediately set about establishing more than two dozen Hebrew language schools. Now, 4 months later, in February of 1914, the language controversy ended when the Board of Governors reconsidered the matter and agreed that all Technion courses would be taught only in Hebrew. From then on, the commitment to a Hebrew vernacular in the Yeshuv was never in doubt. And by 1916, the fulfillment of Ben Yehuda's dream was in sight. A census that year indicated that 40% of the Yeshuv's population spoke Hebrew as their first language. The little philologist's accomplishment was formidable and widely recognized. When Ben Yehuda died in Jerusalem in December of 1922, 30,000 people escorted his body to his grave, and Israel's Jewry observed 3 days of official mourning. And here is the grave of Eliezer Ben Yehuda, 1922, December. 30,000 people escorted the body to his grave. And you can read all about the life of Eliezer Ben Yehuda in the book, The Tongue of the Prophets, by Robert St. John. All right, I can see that we are out of time. We will pick up our study next session in 1822 with Leo Pinsker. 1882, what did I say, 1822? We'll pick up our study next session in 1882 with Leo Pinsker. Leo Pinsker, also a proponent of secular Zionism. So thanks so much for being our students. We'll see you next session. Lehi Thraot. Lehi Thraot.